and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host in Washington, D.C. In recent days, independent bloggers, journalists, and civic activists are going through tough times in Pakistan. These victims have one thing in common, and that is expressing their critical opinion, especially involving radical groups and the powerful military. Enforced disappearance is what they commonly end up with. More importantly, in most cases, no one claims the responsibility for these actions. Pakistan has never been a safe place for independent journalists, but the recent surge is beyond the norms, even in Pakistan's own standards. On this episode of Gandhara Podcast, we will look into some of the recent cases, try to link the dots to understand what this phenomena tells us about the motivation of the criminals, their identities, and figure out where the authorities stand in this horrible crime. To discuss the subject, I have Dr. Farzana Sheikh, who is the senior fellow at the Chatham House, specializing in Pakistan. Dr. Farzana, welcome to the Gandhara.
Hello.
Very nice to have you. Umar Uvaraj, Asia Media Manager at the Amnesty International, who is originally from Pakistan, is also joining us. Umar, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Gibran Nasir, Pakistani civil liberties activist, lawyer and blogger, is joining us. Gibran, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you.
Thank you. Abu Bakr Siddiq, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan, is also with us from Prague today. Abu Bakr, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Before to kick off the debate, let me remind you that please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with the points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt your questions so that we have a lively debate today. With this, Gibran, please take us through some of the recent victims. I believe some of them are released over the weekend. Who are they, the ones who went missing over the past few months or days?
Well, I'm not entirely sure who all went missing. What I'm sure about is the names which came forward, and those were the names of Salman Haider, Asim Saeed, Ahmed Raza Nasir, Waqas Guraya, and one Samar Abbas. With the exception of Samar Abbas, the remaining four have come back. And these four were actually the ones who were being branded as bloggers or as people associated with certain perhaps pages or perhaps writing content on Facebook or Twitter, which was considered controversial by some. And by an extension, after their disappearance, they were also alleged to be involved in blasphemous content, which allegations only came to light post their abduction, not before that in any court of law. But I believe we are gathered here today to take and look at this angle as a violation of human right, and not just a violation of a particular segment of society, the rights of a particular segment of society. When we talk about disappearances or enforced disappearances or missing persons, I think reason that perhaps today people or civil rights group or human rights group are feeling vulnerable or perhaps are feeling isolated in view of these abductions is because we have not subscribed to this value, or we have not shared this value, which is human rights or a right to a fair trial, with other segments of society as well.
Obviously, we will get to the topic, Gibran. Just to a little bit dwindle about the cases that you mentioned, you said four of the recent cases, the people who went missing are back. So the one who is still remains at large, who is that person? What makes him different than the others?
That's Samar Abbas, but Samar Abbas was not running, to the best of my knowledge, any anonymous page like this, or he was not a blogger. He was involved in activism on street, primarily with causes related to violence against Shias in Pakistan. But I would not be able to, and neither did I initially put or brand him in the same categories as the remaining four. So I do not know what was he involved with, which led to his abduction. But whatever it was, whether it's a crime or not, again, I'll endorse the view that we need to get these people through court of law, and we need to give courts and our system the due respect which we need in order for order in our society.
Yes, Umar writes. So what do these victims have in common in terms of profession, background, etc.?
Well, I don't, I mean, as Gibran said, I don't think it matters what they had in common as far as the crime committed against them is concerned. The serious human rights violation, which is their enforced disappearance. What they do have very strikingly in common is how they were disappeared. These are people who were picked up in populated areas where it is rare for people to go missing. They all disappeared within a few days of each other. Unlike a kidnapping, they had their phones on, which were tracked to different locations. Their phones were used to contact the families and tell them where their cars were placed. And now they have been returned to their families. They've been recovered without anyone demanding a ransom or any non-state actor claiming responsibility. So that leaves us to suggest that what they do have in common is that it is highly likely that they were picked up by the Pakistan security forces.
So what's the account of those people who just returned?
Well, I haven't had a chance to speak to them. Perhaps Gibran can tell us a bit more, whether they are speaking, whether they can tell us about who took them, whether they know the identity of the captors, what sort of how they were treated, what questions were asked of them, whether they were subject to any torture and ill treatment. These are questions that need to be asked. And not just that, the people still, we can't see this as a closed chapter. After all, they need to be, whoever abducted them needs to be investigated held accountable.
Yeah. Gibran, what's your information? Did you have the chance to talk to some of those people who came back?
I haven't spoken to anybody in person who's gone missing, but because I had been in touch with all the families, I got the confirmation from the families themselves when they returned, and the fact that they are well, some of them are planning to leave Pakistan, some of them have already changed houses, because it's not that anybody who comes back after abduction does a press conference or tells people what happened to them. But this case is peculiar and it's different because while they were gone, their guilt was associated with the activities considered against the interests of Islam and the country. So for many, they've been painted as traitors, and for the rest, they've been tainted as blasphemers. So much before they even returned to their homes, and I would not use the word recovery because recovery would have been done by an active group. They were just released on the streets, on the roads, near the houses. They have already, the family members have been receiving death threats from different banned militant outfits and groups, and a lot of ridicule from the masses on social media as well. The way their character was assassinated on television, for which, of course, our media regulatory authorities taking action. But they are going through a different circumstance. Not only are they concerned about whether they want confrontation with their abductors, their captors, but they're also concerned about whether coming in public right now is the right move and to tell people about the location is the right move, given the fact that there are many other lunatics out there wanting perhaps to shed blood on the pretext that these guys are blasphemers.
Dr. Farzana, let me bring you here in this. We heard from our today's discussion that there are people among who went missing accused in blasphemy or even being a militant. And also we know from the past that people went missing because of their critical view of the military. What is happening these days in Pakistan in terms of these missing people?
Well, I think that this is probably one of the most disturbing aspects of this case for me because, you know, while we commonly assume and certainly have in the past under repressive military dictatorship in Pakistan, that those who are subjected to gross human rights violations of this sort, by which I mean here enforced disappearance, you know, that they have generally been the victims of groups which, you know, in Pakistan would broadly go by the name of agencies, by which, of course, you know, we all understand the security services. But I think what is so unnerving about these cases is that they have emerged in the context of a climate of what can only be described as vigilantism, which suggests that, you know, there might well be some connivance between Pakistan's security services and groups, factions out there in society who are working independently, but with the full knowledge that they can act with impunity, which, of course, you know, leaves us in a very, very difficult situation, because to try and bring any kind of accountability or bring people to account then becomes extremely challenging. And I think that for me has been the most worrying aspect of these recent disappearances.
Abu Bakr, would you like to jump in?
Well, I would first like to commend the excellent comments our people on the panel have made. I'll just point out to one anomaly here. Normally in any state, there are three pillars of the state. There's judiciary, the executive, and the legislation. In Pakistan's case, all these three pillars of the state are practically unaware of what happened to these people, who is behind these abductions. I mean, I know that the intelligence services or security services are blamed for it. And this is very alarming in the case that this issue has now been more than at least 12, 15 years old. Since 9/11, these kinds of abductions become more common. Balochistan, where there is a separatist nationalist insurgency, we had a lot of these kinds of cases, and then it extended into Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, where we had a Taliban insurgency. And now these, I mean, you can label them as secular bloggers or bloggers who were people who allegedly were writing against some religious extremist groups, and also were questioning the military's power in Pakistan. So we had, if I can remember correctly, a government commission on this issue. And but there is no end to this issue. And the way these people have been abducted, mostly in broad daylight, or at least in places which were public in major cities. And also, more worrying is this whole campaign against anybody who spoke for them or raised their voice. I mean, we should remember that a lot of the social, the human rights activists, people like Gibran or others, they have not said anything that's illegal. They have not blamed anybody. All they have said is that anybody has an issue with these people, they should be dealt within the existing Pakistani laws.
Omar, perhaps you could jump in here. The accusation on blasphemy came out more than once today during the discussion, which became such a contentious issue in Pakistan. Both authorities and radical groups, even some talk show hosts, appears to be actively seeking people to blame and punish on this. Why it is so? Is it always been like this before?
Well, the issue of blasphemy has been a problem for decades in Pakistan, but it's become particularly prominent first when the death penalty was added in 1991, and then subsequently in the most latest phase around the case of Asia Bibi, which also led to, which also involved the assassination of Salman Taseer and Shahbaz Bhatti. The thing about blasphemy is it is a charge that is often leveled in a way that arouses mobs, incites people to take the law into their own hands. And the authorities often stand by, indulging this, or become complicit in the violence that takes place, or excuse it in court. It's very rarely the case that people who have torched the homes of alleged blasphemers or people who have killed alleged blasphemers have been held accountable. We've had some exceptions, such as the execution of Mumtaz Qadri recently. But the way it's used in Pakistan is if someone makes an allegation that someone has blasphemed, that immediately makes them a target. And it makes it very extremely difficult for the person to acquit themselves of the charge, to say that they're innocent, or to prove otherwise. Immediately you have people who single them out, who effectively threaten their lives. They put, by making that charge, they put a target on their backs.
Can I just come in there? And, you know, I think that's what really sets these cases apart. I mean, I can't recall, unless someone can, any other instance where we've had people being disappeared and then, you know, sort of allegations being made about them. I mean, the assumption in the past generally has been that those who have disappeared in this way have either been, members of nationalist insurgencies or, have campaigned against the military. In other words, anti-state. But I think this is the first time that we are seeing a case where we have, had people face allegations, face allegations of being anti-Islamic. And of course, all of this is mired in the controversy around these blasphemy laws, which leaves one with the distinct impression that in some sense these inconvenient bloggers, as it were, can be dealt with by mobs, by crowds, you know, who would be acting in the name of Islam. And, you know, that's really what's so worrying about this.
If I may, not just those who have been abducted, but all those who are speaking in support of their recovery, not just in support of the bloggers or pleading their innocence, just talking about rule of law and the constitution and asking for their recovery, were accused. And it is a very scary thought when you associate with something known as a security agency, the notion of creating insecurity in the masses. It's something very scary. But if you look and go in the little background of this, I believe that Pakistan and any activism which we can do within Pakistan, we can do within the ambits of our constitution. And the only principled position we could take on the issue of abduction was the right to a fair trial as per in accordance with laws of Pakistan. Now, even draconian laws have been passed in Pakistan to provide legal cover to certain activities. We saw a physical manifestation of that 2.5 years ago in the shape of the Protection of Pakistan Act, which allowed for an up to a 90-day detention under legal cover of any person suspected of militancy or terrorism, under, of course, vague definitions of militancy and terrorism. So there is a lot of mistrust between the military and the civilian authorities. Can't ignore that. We can never ignore that. And of course, this mistrust has been also caused primarily because of interferences in the form of dictatorships, where the political, the civilian government feels pretty insecure as well. And when these draconian laws are passed, as it were, in 2014, and they were lapsing in 2016, the civilian government did not do enough to ensure that the law continues to at least bring to logical conclusion the cases already pending under that draconian law, and then those cases are shifted to the anti-terrorism court. What I'm talking about is not the fact that we should impose more draconian laws or we should perpetuate them, but the fact that once there seems to be a commitment between the civilian government and the military government to fight together this menace of terrorism or whoever they consider a threat to the state or the integrity of the nation, again, broad and vague terms in our constitution and our legislation, then that commitment need to be followed to a logical conclusion. You cannot just buckle down under pressure, initially allow for law to take place, allow for courts, further courts to be formed, and then halfway through, without any logical end and conclusion, you just back off. So there was a time, a funny situation, that Pakistan had four parallel legal systems. One was under the ordinary courts, then we had anti-terrorism courts, then we had courts under the Protection of Pakistan Act, and then we had special jurisdiction for military courts. So a lot of this perhaps could be resolved going into the future and suggesting a way forward if legal cover is provided, because we can't deny that Pakistan is, and the security agencies and the military authorities are not without excuse, that Pakistan right now is facing insurgency. It is facing hostile relations with neighbors, partly due to its own misadventures, I would say. But still, right now, we can't disassociate the fact that there are various banned outfits, various guerrilla groups, various terror organizations working in Pakistan. Again, it's open to debate how they were formed and came into being. And again, I say some misadventures led to them. And some perhaps misadventures we continue to carry on with.
You know, it's such a blurred situation when it comes to who is who. Very, very confusing. Thank you very much, Gibran. The fact that we are witnessing huge, search and crime against bloggers, activists, or journalists, and the fact that it is happening all around the country is obviously worrisome in a sense that it makes you wonder whether there is a coordinated campaign going on against a group of people. We will continue to debate, discussing all these questions shortly. But before we get into that aspect, let me recap the debate that today on Gandhara we are discussing increasing toll of missing bloggers and activists in Pakistan and its possible reasons. Discussing the subject with me are Dr. Farzana Sheikh, who is the senior fellow at the Chatham House specializing in Pakistan, Gibran Nasir, Pakistani civil rights activist, blogger and lawyer, is joining us. Omar Vuraich, Asia media manager at the Amnesty International, is with us today. Abu Bakr Siddiq, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan and Afghanistan, is also joining us. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara podcast. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Before the break, we kind of touched upon this question. We are clearly witnessing a surge in campaign against bloggers and activists. So why it is happening now? Does the timing tell us anything, Abu Bakr?
Well, I think there is one point that I would like to make, and our other panelists are welcome to expand on it, or disagree with me. I think we are basically witnessing two kinds of Pakistan. One is the periphery Pakistan, one is the core Pakistan. By periphery, I mean provinces and outlying regions like tribal areas, Balochistan, even Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, part of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. And then there is what is essentially the core of Pakistan, which is the eastern province of Punjab or the main cities in Punjab, and also Karachi or the urban area of Karachi. So what has been happening in Pakistan in terms of enforced disappearances is that this was primarily a problem of periphery, where there were insurgency, I mean, different but complicated insurgencies. And in case of Pakistani laws, maybe Pakistan as a state was not prepared to deal with those kinds of insurgency. Like, for example, in tribal areas, there was a law called the Frontier Crimes Regulation, which is a century-old colonial law. It's very discriminatory and highly abusive, but it's not a law that's designed to deal with a complex Taliban and Al-Qaeda insurgency. So the military went in into tribal areas and then they literally captured a lot of essentially Taliban fighters, and then they had to deal with those guys. In Balochistan, which was a very different case, they had the separatist struggle, political, kind of leftist inspired, not religious at all, but it was, in military view, an anti-state activity. So they, in a way, copied what India did, perhaps, in Kashmir in the previous decade, where there were similar cases of enforced disappearances and things. What is lacking here is, I agree with Gibran that a civilian government has to do something, but this issue has to move on the top of the agenda of mainstream Pakistani political parties. In Balochistan, there has been a lot of campaign by the Baloch nationalists. In Pashtunkhwa, there has been some campaigning. Now, in Karachi, there is some campaigning regarding this issue by the MQM party, which is now on the wrong side of Pakistani military establishment. But it has never been a top agenda for Pakistan People's Party or Pakistan Muslim League, the two main party, and also now for Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. So the political leadership has to first do their homework. This is an issue that needs to be debated and discussed extensively in the Pakistani parliament.
All these are obviously logical explanations, Abu Bakr. But in terms of timing, I hate to say this, but is there anything bloggers or journalists have to do in this search? I guess my question is, are they doing something different than before, pushing the boundaries too much, digging into certain groups' interests? Who wants to take the question? Maybe.
I think, Mohammed, I think I remember a few years ago, and Gibran probably remembers this, is that on Twitter, for example, there were not that many Pakistani users. It was everyone had a few hundred, maybe, followers at the most. And it was quite an open space. As we, you know, as we've entered what Pankaj Mishra calls this age of anger, social media has become a combustible space right across the world. Some, for example, said, well, the convulsions you saw in the Arab world in 2011, these were involved in them, or the Trump ascendancy in the United States that we've seen of late. And for the Pakistani establishment, their question has been, well, how do they control this? They had studied and found ways through coercion and through consent and through other manipulative methods to control the mainstream media, which was newspapers first and then television once it became privatized. So what the biggest challenge for them was actually dealing with the privatized and the profusion of television channels from the Musharraf years onwards. And now they're facing this worrying prospect of having to deal with people on social media who can assume anonymous identities and say things that will get traction, that will be seen as inconvenient, that will be seen as insulting, that will be seen as a potential problem. It seems as if the emphasis is not to allow a certain amount of dissent and see that as, well, that's just the price you have to pay for technology to be around, but they want total control. They want conformity. And I think that is very much sort of what is behind this.
Can I come in here and just say that perhaps, you know, we need to face squarely the possibility that we are talking about a country, Pakistan, where much as we would like to believe it, the rule of law as we know it is virtually non-existent. You know, we have rules, we have laws. In 2013, you remember the Supreme Court came out with a verdict saying that, you know, those responsible for enforced disappearances should be dealt with strictly. They should be brought before courts of law. There hasn't been a single prosecution. No one has ever been held to account for their part in enforced disappearances or the violation of human rights. So I think, you know, it's not so much that we lack rules or we lack laws. It's that we do not live in a state where these rules or these laws matter much, which is not to say that we shouldn't continue to press for them. But it is a very depressing commentary, I think, on the state of Pakistan, where, in effect, despite all our talk about a transition to democracy, about a rule, about the rule of law, we still have a country which is heavily dominated by the military, and heavily skewed in favor of the interests of the so-called military establishment and its security agencies. And I think, you know, that is really the nub of the problem.
One more.
Could I just come in there? I mean, I think Fazana makes a very good point about the breakdown of law and order. At the same time, we have seen that the authorities are very good at enforcing certain laws that they have recently put in place. So you can get convictions for people under cybercrime legislation, for example. You can get convictions for people on a whole slew of what I would call draconian laws. But at the same time, there is impunity, as Fazana said, for these major human rights violations. And as long as that impunity lasts, and it is seen as, those things are not seen as a problem at all, or as seen as a problem in terms of enforcing law and order, but there is an emphasis instead on these draconian and repressive laws, this will continue to be a problem.
Your organization had a statement several weeks ago in which it appears that you are blaming security agencies involving in some of these missing people's cases. What makes you confident that it is indeed the case?
No, I'm not confident of that fact. I think there should be an investigation. But what we do know is that the pattern of these enforced disappearances, just from their circumstances, suggests that they may be some state involvement. As I said earlier, these are not, if you look at what's happened in terms of the way they were picked up, the way that they were subsequently released, the media chorus that came from certain surrogates during this period in time, the fact that no ransom or responsibility was called out for, it suggests that these are, you know, this is, that these were enforced disappearances of a very, very familiar, depressingly familiar pattern.
You know, allegations are very against these victims, but the fact that the cases of missing bloggers are emerging from every corner of Pakistan makes you wonder whether there is a coordinated campaign against them. What is your reading on the ground, Gibran? Do you feel that?
First of all, let us focus back on the point that all the missing people who were abducted or went missing went within the jurisdiction of one province, and that is Punjab. And it made news headlines and, of course, caused commotion and panic and frenzy amongst the influentials, because as Abu was recently previously highlighting, that there are two kinds of Pakistan, at least socially, economically, and politically. Yeah. And the Punjab heartland is considered to be that mainstream Pakistan, which always is very easily catching attention of the media. Was this a coordinated effort? Most definitely. Is any non-state actor capable of doing so? Very much so. Again, the point is that even if any agency is or is not involved in this, nothing stops our civilian law enforcement agencies, which primarily includes our police, and then certain other institutions like the FIA, to investigate what happened, who took them, and where it's going to go. Again, my question is going to be, will the civilian government pursue it or not? Is the onus or the responsibility of the missing bloggers already harassed and traumatized and their families to pursue this? Or is it responsibility of the state to do so? Because one cannot take away from the fact that the kind of protection our ministers or our police officials or our federal agency officials would enjoy, citizens don't. Huh. And similarly, they're privy to certain knowledge which we are not.
Okay. Let me
can I just step yes. in here just for 1 minute to clarify a small point? Gibran, tell me, in Pakistan, has there been a single senior official, either within the government or the military establishment, who have recognized this case that we're talking, or these cases that we are talking about today, as cases of enforced disappearance? At a minimum, it seems to me that there needs to be an acknowledgement that these five bloggers were disappeared. Has there been any official or formal recognition of this? I haven't read it, but
no, there have been denials. The Interior Minister.
That's my reading of it.
See, the thing is that when this incident came to light,
You have to recognize that an offense took place. I mean, I'm using a very mild word. An offense took place to bring someone to account.
Sorry to interrupt you. When this incident happened, and the senators, primarily Senior Senator Faratullah Babar, came out, he actually hinted this to be an enforced disappearances. And in response, when the Interior Minister was summoned to the Senate, he did say on the floor of the Senate that this is a heinous crime, what these abductions which have happened. And then he also kept clarifying in his presses that any campaign maligning these bloggers should not be allowed to continue. But even though they were continued, and no executive order was issued in relation to that. So that's what my point is, that right now the DG ISPI has come about and said that we are not associated with anything which had happened to the bloggers. So he's defending the military organizations. But when Nisar has himself said that this is a heinous crime, this is my question, that they need to pursue it to the logical end to find the criminal as well.
Okay, Gibran, if you, as an activist, if you go to, for example, a police station, what reaction you get from them when you press authorities to do something about this?
I'll give you an example. Only 3 days ago in Islamabad High Court, the police official was summoned because an FIR was registered about somebody who went missing around 2 months ago. And within the FIR, now this again comes down to the families. Families are primarily the people when somebody goes missing who go and register the case. The families in this instance, a separate one from these bloggers, mentioned and accused the security agencies to be responsible for the abduction. So that came about in the court as a matter of contention. The police was called only 3 days ago. This is perhaps one of the most notable cases where the senior police official came in court and testified that according to police investigations, they also believe that agencies are behind it. And then accordingly, the court was empowered based on the testimony of the police, who were empowered by the family coming out and complaining the matter as it is to the best of their knowledge. And now a joint investigation team has been set up to actually inquire into the agencies who are being accused now for picking this up. So this has to come into a cycle. But again, I'm going to say, not every time you're going to find families brave enough who've gone through trauma and harassment and fear to come up and registered strong cases. The police and the government has to step up so that this precedent, which we just saw 3 days ago, does become the norm. And until unless it does not become the norm, these abductions will continue to be the norm.
Abu Bakr, under the shadow of this very, I should say, depressing situation, the bottom line is how it is affecting journalism or journalists or the bloggers. And you, I know that you you work with many of them in the country. So what is your impression? How all this situation is affecting the journalism in the country?
Well, I do work with a lot of journalists, and I do know them. I think one of the basic problems in Pakistan is that the Pakistani state needs to have, used to have a kind of a monopoly over the domestic narrative, and also by extension the international narrative about Pakistan. And they used to do it by a monopoly over information over media. I mean, there was used, 15 years ago, there was only the state TV in Pakistan. There is only the state radio in Pakistan. And then, of course, a monopoly over the Urdu press in particularly. I think Pakistani English language press is still relatively free. I mean, maybe the freest in the region because very few Pakistanis actually read it. Wow. But that, all that changed with the kind of boom in the electronic media by, all these various television channels in the 2000s under Musharraf, and then now the social media. So I agree with Umar that this is kind of a state's effort, or maybe a powerful or institution within the state's effort to reassert itself. I've seen a lot of Pakistani officials complaining in previous years that they have completely lost control over the narrative. And I mean, one of the dominant narrative on social media in Pakistan has always been this allegation that there is some kind of collision between the extremists groups and Pakistani military. So perhaps this is now we are seeing that this is a deliberate effort. But I will also make the point that linking this issue, the freedom of speech, to insurgencies or people who have taken up guns against the state is extremely dangerous for journalists and bloggers.
Obviously, there are a lot to talk, but we have to end our discussion. But the final point that is, we criticize authorities a lot because they deserve criticism because they are in the position of authority. So, Omar, perhaps you might wish to comment on this. Recently, Amir Liaquat, one of the prominent talk show hosts on local TV, was banned by the government because of his apparent support of some of these abductions. It appears that the authorities are not sitting entirely idle in this. What was your reading from this punishment of Amir Liaquat?
Well, Amir Liaquat, I think the less said, the better. I think the man is a charlatan and a general nuisance, but he's also a very dangerous nuisance. I think it has been, they were absolutely right to get rid of someone who incites violence on television, but this is not the first time he's done it. He did this a number of years ago when he said Ahmadis are liable to be killed, that they are wajib al-qatl. And he was taken off, and after that, three Ahmadis were killed in Sindh province. And yet he returned to television, and he's returned in different guises. And somehow he is able to reincarnate himself and have an afterlife, even after he was banned, for example, his program was allowed to continue. So, there needs to be some real consistency when it comes to these things.
Okay. I don't like to end the debate with such a blurred picture. So, in few words, each of the panelists, so what has to happen to change this trend in the country? Abu Bakr, perhaps let's start with you.
There is a need to end this impunity, and everything the state wants to do with its citizens or any allegations, even if people are accused of being anti-state, they need to be dealt with some kind of within the remit of law. And Pakistan has all these laws in the judicial system. Maybe it's not the best judicial system, but still the government and the military needs to rely on that system to deal with anything. And I think they should not conflate journalism and reporting in media or social media with kind of more serious armed insurgents or separatists.
Dr. Farzana, so what has to happen other than banning Amir Liaquat to have a positive change?
Yes, I think that's likely just to be a temporary ban. We've been here before. I'm afraid I'm not at all optimistic. What must happen? I think we all know what must happen. The question is, will it happen? Hmm. What must happen is for our civilian government, our elected government, to face up to its responsibilities and to face up to its primary responsibility, which is to enforce the rule of law. I myself have very serious doubts about whether or not it can do that, because the actual configuration of power in Pakistan, which has remained fundamentally unchanged since the inception of the state, I'm afraid simply militates against that.
Omar, is there anything international community can do to make Pakistan act?
I don't think so. I think this is these are problems that would have to be dealt with internally in Pakistan. After all, if there is any sort of foreign influence, it tends to be an excuse used for people to delegitimize the effort underway. So I think it will be a very tough situation for the coming period. But I am at the same time encouraged by the number of people who bravely spoke out and the fact that these people are now back with their families. However, the damage done, both in terms of the wounds that they may have sustained, be those psychological, emotional, or physical, needs to be accounted for.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last point, Gibran. So what do you want to see happening in the country?
Well, see, two things have come out. One is, of course, a case of abduction, and for that I'll again go to the matter that the civilian government needs to sit down with the military leadership and design legal cover which is plausible under the constitution for any acts which they think are important to ensure security of the country, and again also come out and for once and for all try and attempting to define these vague terms like national integrity and national security, because everything seems to be caught up in it, and go towards making our judicial system more proactive and better. On the second thing, this whole debate which opened about hate speech and television being used as a tool for murder, if I may borrow from the words of another senior journalist, Wasatullah Khan, I, though, have complained and wanted the ban to be imposed, but that's under the existing system where I am. I'm not pro-ban. The ban culture is promoted, and if it goes, if it's perpetuated, gives more authority to regulators and more authorities, which means that the potential for abuse becomes more as well. So going for bans and going for shut-up calls may actually come down and hamper our freedoms tomorrow as well. What we need is deterrence. And deterrence comes from A, awareness of laws, and B, enforcement of laws. There is not enough awareness amongst the masses of Pakistan regarding the difference between free speech or hate speech, or for that matter, any fundamental human right under the constitution. So we have failed on that account. And then there is not enough notion of deterrence because of our judicial system. So for the future, I would like that awareness and that deterrence to come into play, as opposed to us imposing ad hoc bans and shutting everybody who we don't like.
Thank you very much for your insightful comments, Gibran Nasir, Pakistani civil liberties activist, blogger, and lawyer. Dr. Farzana Sheikh, the senior fellow at the Chatham House, specializing in Pakistan. Omar Waraj, Asia media manager, Amnesty International. Abu Bakr Sadiq, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Gandhara website, for being with us today and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, your host in Washington, D.C. Until the next podcast, bye-bye.